Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Grey Leopard Code with Gary Norris Gray. Gary will be coming to you each Saturday, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, talking sports live on GLC.
Robinson, Muhammad Ali to Michael Jordan and Shaq, football, basketball, baseball, and everything in between. We focus on all the major players and stories, daily features, video on demand, and Black Athlete newspapers coming to a city near you. Tired of the same old sports programming? Check out blackathlete.com. Sports the way you like it.
Breaking news. A Asian Boeing 777 has just crashed in San Francisco Airport. From Seoul, Korea, we got our news here. Most of the people got out of the plane. The tail ripped off. Breaking news out of the Bay Area. So, if you have friends in Korea, you would check on them. We don't know the number of the plane. Breaking news out of San Francisco. Alright. Reality sets in. In sports and stuff, at least we get reality here. As we go on, welcome to the GLC. Get out straight. Go into sports at 727-3649. Thank you to GLC for another year, 7 years. Right, welcome to sponsor Reality Sports Group of Robinson, Virginia. And good news, go for send it to GaryGrayBlackAthlete.com, NordIndiaATT.net, DIY Rose Market at 5033 Ocean, California, 510-235, 1233. The New England Reformer Magazine, Doreen Wade, CEO, Boston, Massachusetts. The radio show is there Sunday afternoons. Sound by TJRadio.com and WVON 1090 AM Chicago. You can learn www.wvon.com or Board Roundtable. Alright, we just had a thing with Michael Goldstein Room an hour ago. Alright, so it's really wrong. Saturdays, 11 to 1, Pacific, and 2 to 4 in the East. And yeah, we got, don't come in here. Gotta be strong. 718-508-9216. And get your Philly crew on. With the Soul Patrol. And my sick home, WCLM 14 with Cabo Ready, and WCLM Radio Online.com. You want your old school music? Get the BD Brown, get down. And don't forget the little old Mystery Man. Every Saturday has to do with the old school music, with the 50s and 60s. And 70s. Also, a buddy from Buffalo, New York, Matt Freeman, Mighty Oba, WUFO 1080, Buffalo, New York. And also remembering our founding father, Roy Rogers, CEO, BSN, New York City, New York, and the family of BSN writers. And broadcasters, can't forget 609-707, Mr. B.R. today. Join the Gold Caravan, Soul Patrol, and ATWCM on Facebook.com. Read articles on BlackAdvocate.com and get a different look at sports. Get up a call, 646-727-3649. Like I said, breaking news out of the Bay Area. 777 from Seoul, Korea has crash landed at SFO, San Francisco Airport, about a half hour ago. There are multiple survivors as the plane did not break up. Luckily, so I think we might get away with one this time. Breaking news out of Bay Area. Any relatives from Korea, you need to check on them, see where they are. All right, they get the fire out. They're watching it on CNN. Brad Landy at SFO. Half hour ago. I'm Boeing 777 from Seoul, Korea. Asiana Airlines. Okay. Also breaking news. Dwight Howard is going to Houston. And the best thing that ever happened to Dwight Howard. He's going to go to Houston, get away from Hollywood, get away from the glare and the glitz of Hollywood. The Warriors have moved to their lineup with Andre Iguodala. Andre Iguodala is a forward center who played for the Philadelphia Sixers. Now, I played for Denver last year. He will now be playing for the Golden State Warriors and Mark Jackson. This morning, Bartoli wins Women's. And he beats Leszczynski in straight sets. And it wasn't even close. The two players had different opposing styles. So, Bartoli wins Wimbledon early this morning. Okay. We have a special guest today, lawyer and graduate student from University of California, Berkeley Law School, Bull Hall. Kathleen Wells from KCAA. And the Imperial Empire down near Rancho Cucamonga. Not that name. And we will talk about the gentleman trial. From a lawyer standpoint, and Oscar Grant, who was also slain by Bart, police officer, and the Hernandez case. These are not sports issues. It means like half of the show. The first half of the show will be sports, like half of the show will be legal business. So, they have for the day. News of the week. The Brazilian team is mad at Spain for the Confederation Cup. And the Brazilian is ready for 2014 World Cup soccer. Next year, and that should be interesting because Brazil and Spain will probably meet again for the World Cup Championship. Oregon look better this year, but no, not in the glass. I'm with the Brazilians or the Spanish. No fans. I mean, the NHL draft was this week. And no fans booed, I mean, really booed Gary Bettman for lack of leadership in the NHL. And the first black player to get drafted, Bobby Jones' son, Seth Jones, be number four. Do I have a conspiracy here? This is why a black player be number one. I'm telling you, there's no reason why Seth Jones did not go to Colorado because he's a Colorado native. The Colorado Avalanche knew about this guy, and they knew that I'd pick him. Well, as Nashville brothers, good fortune, and Seth Jones goes to Nashville. The Devils signed the son of Goldie, Martin Brodeur. He will be a Devil. As the Rock crowd goes nuts when the Devils announced Brodeur's son as a Devil. The Devils also are moving into the future when they traded for Corey Snyder, who is 27 years old, 11 years younger than Marty Brodeur. So we might be seeing the end of one of the greatest goaltenders of all time, Marty Brodeur, who played for one team and one team only, the New Jersey Devils, who has three Stanley Cups and will be in the Hall of Fame after he retires. And the Brodeur name will continue with Brodeur's son getting drafted last week. The Flyers get Tampa Bay I was there, and now it will booster the Philadelphia Flyers offense. And yesterday, they also got Sugar Ray, my man Sugar Ray from Chicago. So the Flyers are meaning serious business and getting back into the Western, Eastern Conference race. Yes, indeed. Sugar Ray in a Philadelphia Flyers uniform. Once again, Mr. Emery will be wearing orange and black. Next question. Why are the Phoenix Coyotes in Arizona? They should be moving north. The Phoenix Coyotes are the second lowest attendance. They had problems paying the salary 2 years ago. And moving to Seattle would be a natural thing. All the teams would be in the Pacific time zone. There'd be no question about travel time. So, when will Phoenix Coyotes move either to Seattle or Quebec City? We won't know. And Tuesday to the White House, we won't know what happened. Milwaukee Bucks guard, Danny Reddick, when the LA Clippers, Eric Bledsoe moved to the Phoenix Suns, everybody moved over everywhere. But at the end of next week, we will know who will be where and when. So, as of now, Iggy Dagger, is a Golden State Warriors. Howard is a Houston Rockets. Redick is a Eric Clippers. And Bledsoe is a Philly Suns. More later. Mr. Goodell. Many of the teacher guys that behave themselves. Mr. Goodell, where is your badge? Another football player gets arrested for alleged throwing a beer can at another player in a fight at a bar. Look, guys, stop the foolishness. Nothing goes well after midnight. But every guy out there, after midnight, nothing goes good after midnight. So when midnight comes, you just go take a little behind and go home. That's what you need to do. Ahmad Brooks will have to deal with the local police because he got mad and threw a beer at somebody. Okay? When is it going to stop? The boss is telling me. The boss did tell it. You know, this team amazes me. The boss is telling me. Trey Garnett and Beard to the Brooklyn and Brooklyn Nets. They move Coach Doc Rivers out. And now they're trying to get rid of Rondo. Rajon Rondo. Are you kidding me? Rajon Rondo is the only player you got. And add to that, you get a college coach on the Butler Bulldogs. Brad Stevens. And once again, a young white male moves in the pro spots while black and indigenous have to wait another year. I did an article on NBA coaches, and this year, there were 5 NBA coaches that went down, and we gained only 2. 2 rookie coaches. Jason Kidd being one of them. Now, the NBA has 81-year history. 81-year history. How many black coaches have they had? 80. That's 1 per year. Now, don't forget, the first 20 years, they were 0. And speaking of Boston Celtics, Bill Russell, J.C. Jones, and Doc Ellis, Ring a Bell. Well, ladies and gentlemen, all 3 of those African American gentlemen won NBA titles. No other team with black coaches have won the NBA title. Let me repeat that again. Bill Russell, K.C. Jones, and Doc Rivers, all the Boston Celtics, all have won NBA titles. What does that say? Now, in between 1997 and 2004, Doc Rivers won more games than any of those guys before him. Yeah, Rick Pitino. Yeah, he was a bozo. He didn't win that many. So, again, black contestants have to wait in line. And Doc Rivers goes to L.A. And he watched 2 years of L.A. win a championship. And Doc Rivers won't get his due. What can I say? On Thursday, it's 4th of July. And the hot dog contest. And please, please, stop the hot dog contest. It's not sports. It is not sports. Just give the awards to Mr. Chestnut. And Ms. Young, or Ms. Thomas, who won the division the fourth time, and not sports. I don't eat it, not sports. So New York, please, stop stopping, right? Thank you very much. ESPN, yeah, my buddy, the rat, the mouse, the rodent, everyone called, was overjoyed. Why are they overjoyed? They're overjoyed because all the bios in Wimbledon are Europeans. Sloane's Demons, Nali, and Lindsay Girl, Serena Williams, did not win this week. So we had a final of Bartoli and Lizzie Sabine and Lizzie. Did anybody watch it? I know I didn't. It's a contrast of style and contrast of the way people play. I'll see the review at the end of the show. Bartoli and Lizinski. Lizinski is a baseline player while Bartoli charges the net. I guess, where did he get that from? The Rio Sisters. Okay, it's Friday. It's Friday. You need homework? Did you support black businesses? Did you buy black? I'm going to say this every week of the year. Every week of the year, I'm going to say this. Because it needs to be addressed. We have lost our center, our culture, our support. We need to support black businesses. I know it sounds bad, but it's real. Our economy is $8 billion. And where is it going? Not back in the black community. $8 billion. Okay? We need to wake up. All right. The captain back in New York Yankee uniform, and Derek Jeter returns to the field while A-Rod Alex Rodriguez moves to Carolina in the Carolina League before he goes to Trenton in the next few weeks. So he'll be a Trenton Yankee in about another week. Yoko Rayton and Murray will meet tomorrow in the men's gentlemen's bio next week in Wimbledon. Scottish Murray and Yoko Rayton. Murray is running history And 75 years of that time, a Englishman has won Wimbledon. The Flyers get Sugar Ray Emery from Chicago. And the Blackhawks have made a big mistake. Now we have Corey Crawford in there. And I know Corey Crawford. Crawford is not going to go on, you know. And Emery Dade is behind this year. As he went 17-1. The Blackhawks have not won the Stanley Cup without Ray Emery. And why did the Flyers go to the Eastern Conference Finals? Sugar Ray Emery, again wearing black and orange this year. Boston Orange will be going to Columbus, Ohio at the Columbus Blue Jackets. And Boston's going to miss him. The New Jersey Devils signed Ryan Crow from the Cross River Cross Hudson Rival New York Rangers. Everybody in New Jersey are not happy because they lose Clarkson, who goes to Toronto. And people are wondering if Clarkson is not better than Glow. Glow will be wearing Devil Red, and Clarkson will be wearing Toronto Blue next year. And, oh man, if I'm an Ottawa Senator fan, I am in agony right now. Albertson will be going to the Detroit Red Wings. And Albertson was all the offense that Ottawa Senators had. And now he's going to Detroit. So the question is Ottawa rebuilding in the Canadian capital? We shall see. Okay. Let me take a break here and get back to you in a few. Break time. my girlfriend, Rainy Adventure. Yeah, back in the day. Rainy Adventure. All right. Let's get the baseball, man.
Very good.
I give Ray of Azov and the Hurricanes. I don't know why I picked them because they needed defense. But they picked Elias Lindholm, center. First five picks, three are centers. So the NHL is going for all but this year. We'll see. Watch out for Seth Jones. When he plays great hockey player, I think he's going to change the National Hockey League. Yes, indeed. Okay, I have a bowl to pick here. And we got people over here today. 804 and 85, boys.
Uh-oh.
The Ingram and Calvin Reggie both at the same time.
You know what they say, we all look alike.
I don't know, but Dwight Howard with his new picture, they got him with dreadlocks, like in a WNBA. I don't know, but guys, something I want to throw at real quick. Okay, now when it came to the hockey draft, you know, we talked about it on our show today, and I don't know how you feel about it, but yeah, I was hoping that the young man be drafted first, but you're seeing 3 or 4 years where those individuals are drafted in front of him. And if they fall on their face and this young man can be the class that we think they are, somebody needs to be fired. Now, what's your thoughts on that, Mike?
Well, firstly, I'd have to say, I know Gary was talking about it as I jumped in, but I watched that draft. I watched the whole first round, and the announcers, the so-called experts, the insiders,
yep,
everyone to a man said, without a doubt, Seth Jones not only should have been drafted first, but
yep,
was the most NHL ready player at his position. Now, that Sakic took MacKinnon instead of Jones wasn't so much an issue, because that we could make apples and oranges. The goal for Colorado was to have strength up the middle. And regardless of whatever team sport it is, baseball, football, basketball, hockey, strength up the middle is always important. So with this kid that they picked up, they feel they have at least three strong center lines,
yep,
or three centers holding off lines, maybe even four, given the depth of whatever it is they have in the system, or what they want to carry with what their regular roster will be when the season starts. But Jones was perfect. So you thought even if they chose MacKinnon, Jones was going number two, and that the Florida Panthers, who needed some defense, sure, shit would have took them. They didn't. Tampa Bay, who surely needed defense, didn't take them. So it goes to Gary's point about the teams making the excuse that they want offense. But but Jones is going to have the last laugh in my humble, because he fell into a perfect situation in Nashville.
Nashville, yeah.
And this is for two reasons. Nashville was on that precipice of teams that were going to get forced out of the league because they simply didn't have any money.
Right.
And remember, the commissioner, Bettman, didn't do them any favors because he had 3 work stoppages in 6 years.
Yep.
Their biggest piece, Shea Weber, a big defenseman, was that close to being whisked away and signed by my Philadelphia Flyers.
Yeah.
But Nashville kept him, even though his contract would have been almost all of their net worth, which at the time was about $165 million. So they kept Weber. Their draft and their farm system found a fantastic goaltender named Pekka Rinne. And Rinne and Weber and the coaching system deployed the defensive system, not quite like the Devil's left-wing walk system that Gary has always talked about, but it's a variation of. So now you've got Seth Jones at 6'4", 210 pounds, a man. Big, nasty, who can go from end to end on the ice. Like I said, he's got all the tools. A lot of times these kids need to be down on the farm for a year, or they'll play in the minors, or in the minor league, or they'll play in college. But Many of them need seasoning. Seth Jones can play on Nashville's defensive pairings right now. And with somebody like Shea Weber to learn from, with the system that they deploy, with Rene's goaltending, provided he doesn't slack off any, and I don't see it happening anytime soon, Nashville's going to be a pain in the ass for everybody to play. And I think young Mr. Jones will have the last laugh, because when they stepped to him about being drafted and they asked him about the three teams before him and they asked if he'd be motivated to do it, and he sounded like a Canadian kid. Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I'm going to be hard playing. I'm going to play hard against all of them. You know, and I know what he meant, because the translation was, oh, I'm going to whip everybody's ass when I get out there, believe me. And there was another black player, Darnell Nurse, who was drafted by the Edmonton Oilers in the seventh round. I was on the phone with my oldest daughter, Nikki, and my son-in-law when I told them about this as they were driving somewhere. He said, we need a defense. I said, you're going to get it. This kid nurses the truth. He's 6'4", 215. He's tough around the net. He will protect the high-skilled players on the team, because he will fight, even though defensemen shouldn't. But he will fight, and he's got a nasty streak to boot. So the first time in a long time, the NHL draft, again, has a couple of gold brothers in the top 10. But this was something I got Negro Domus points for, Gary. I have to take my Negro Domus points, because I said years ago that the NHL was going to have a race problem as the more and more gold brothers were starting to become more prominent, and not just being role players, but be getting prominent and gaining prominent roles in ice time. We're going to see that backlash. We saw that when Dustin Byfuglien, then with the Chicago Blackhawks, was lifting the Stanley Cup, and he was being booed. Now, it wasn't just because he was being booed because he was in Philly. He was being booed because he was black. Now, that's straight-up truth. They had other players on the Blackhawks who they traded because, again, they were getting hassled about the number of black players they had on their team. This is something that's been coming down the pike.
My next question to you is, why did Chicago let Ray Emery go to Philadelphia?
They let Ray Emery go because Ray Emery did them a big friggin' favor. Ray Emery got them a Stanley Cup. Was Ray Emery in the Nets for that? No. But if it weren't for Ray Emery, Corey Crawford never had the chance to rest in between. He never would have had the opportunity, because I truly believe, and I think you do too, Gary, if Ray Emery hadn't gotten hurt near the end of the regular season, he would have been in net for the playoffs. Kendall would have started him because he lost with Corey Crawford to Phoenix the year before. But when Crawford came back after the Blackhawks were down and got that series, he got his mojo. So once that was confirmed, and now he's a Stanley Cup goaltender, now Ray Emery comes back to Philly, where he actually has a shot at winning the starting job, because he was 16-11-4, even when he was hurt in the Nets for Philadelphia. Even hurt, he was their best goaltender, and he had a wicked hip injury. It took him over a year for the injury to heal and for him to get back to proper speed as a goaltender. And even then, he was doing a good job backing up Josef Heller in Anaheim as a Duck. So as he quacked his way out of there and went to Chicago, they would have kept Ray forever. This was actually a gracious move on the part of the Blackhawks, because they realized, okay, Ray, you helped us get here. Ray Emery had the best winning percentage of any goaltender in National Hockey League history for a season. Book it. He was 17-1-1.
Yeah.
Now that's in the 85-plus percentile, 90-plus percentile. No goalie's ever done that.
My next question is, I was a Stanley Cup player of every game.
Mm-hmm.
Corey Crawford has a weakness. That weakness is his glove side.
I watched
it over and over again.
Yep.
And I'll tell you, this year he was. People are going to be gunning for that glove side.
Well, your Chicago Blackhawks already picked up Nikolai Hobby Bulin, the Bulin Wall, to back up Crawford. So that has been solved. But when you look at the fact that Ray Emery is coming back to a city where he's not intimidated by Flyer fans. If anything, he's pugnacious. We know that Ray Emery will fight. He's beaten a couple of goaltenders behinds while he's been on the ice. So all of this good stuff is there. He's there with a team that needs goaltending badly. Ironically, he and Steve Mason, who's the other goaltender, are next-door neighbors back in Ontario. So the Flyers got over easy on this because they ate a lot of contract on Ilya Brizgalov. But they benefit because they have two solid goaltenders. And really, if Emery doesn't win out, it's no surprise because Mason was a Vezina trophy candidate when he came into the league. So Philly upgraded their goaltending by leaps and bounds. They got rid of somebody who at times plays well but is a bit shaky in Brizgalov. And now the Flyers benefit. So the move of Emery just indicates another aspect of how black players are influencing the National Hockey League, whether the National Hockey League wants it or not. And they're going to have to come to grips with that because now that Jerome McGinley signed with the Boston Bruins, now that Evander Kane is a bona fide star, even though very few people, American fans, know about him because he's in Winnipeg, now that Wayne Simmons is established in Philly, and these ain't just light-skinned brothers who you might want to make a pass on, now that Chris Stewart is one of the best players in the NHL that nobody knows about in St. Louis, the brothers are coming out. They're not just gold brothers now. They're damn good hockey players, and the NHL better learn how to promote them properly. Otherwise, they're going to have to come to a fork in the road with their own judgment. You know, we're not going to see any more bananas hit the ice unless there's some ice cream on top of it and some chocolate syrup. Otherwise, there's going to be some serious problems in the NHL.
Michael, my next question to you is, what are they going to do with the Southern teams, i.e., Florida Panthers, Tampa Bay Lightning, Carolina Hurricane, Nashville Predators? These teams are in serious financial trouble. What is Pepe going to do with these teams?
Well, we talked about marketing, right? This is where the NHL is going to have to bust their behind and roll up their sleeves and put in the time. They already know. You know, you had Steven Stamkos in Tampa Bay. You know, you've got some budding stars in Florida, but nobody really knows who the hell they are.
Right.
Carolina had some talent, you know, but you've
they
got...
They gave it all away.
Exactly, but you've got Nashville as probably the banner team for that division. And you know the Devils, so you know Nashville plays like the Devils do. They will bore you to death, but they will win. And we know for TV and for pumping things up, that's not always the best way unless you have announcers there that make everybody understand the nuances as to why Nashville is a great defensive team and why their style usually adds up to wins without putting people to sleep.
Well, we're waiting for our guest to show up. Cassie Wells with KCAA.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 1:51 right now. It should be about 2:00 when he steps in. I got work for me 2:00. So we continue to talk. Cowboy, are you there? Cowboy.
Yes, sir. I mean, I just say the same thing again. That baseball has a problem marketing when it comes to African Americans and hockey. We see the same thing again. So they're going to have to step up to the plate. I mean, the ground is fertile for diversity, but they got to step up and do it.
My next subject, I'm going to move on to the next subject. The Washington Football Club. And, you know, I really get tired of this.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, pretend Indian or make believe Indian, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
goes on the air.
Hey, go, my friend. Yo.
Goes on the air and says he was he said the R word in the American.
Mm-hmm.
He's an American Indian from the Inuit tribe of Alaska. Now, Michael and I both know that nobody from the First Nation or Native American Indian ever uses the R word to describe themselves. Michael,
exactly right.
This is the kind of heinousness that Daniel Snyder is about. You know, it's one thing to be a football fan and be passionate for your team. But when you see something as out-and-out blatant as this, how could anybody keep an affiliation as a fan for a team like this unless they were an a-hole themselves? Here's your owner, the owner of your team that you root for, telling you it's okay to use a pejorative to describe the team. You know, hail to the niggas. I mean, you might as well be saying that because to Native brothers and sisters, that's what that sounds like because that's what it is.
Wait,
but to
wait.
The fake chief, but to the fake chief that they're talking about, you know, he can't be Aleut and Inuit. You either are Aleut or Inuit. I can say this for fact because I lived in British Columbia for 12 years. And natives up there are First Nations. They refer to themselves First Nations people. And the tribes are called bands. And at no time in the 12 years I was there have I ever heard any Native brother or sister say that R word to each other or against each other. It isn't used. And Aleuts and Inuits are two different peoples. You don't call one the other because that's a falsehood. It's a fallacy. They're two separate, distinct people, and their bloodlines haven't been running concurrent or mixed in over 6,000 years. That's established fact. So that Daniel Snyder would go as far as he could go to put this person out here to justify his arrogance in telling you that he'll call his team the Washington Niggers and you guys will like it because he's never going to change the name is disgusting.
Well, let me say this. If that team was named the Washington Kites, Minnesota would not be very happy.
Mm-hmm.
I know this because he has a Jewish descent. He would not be pleased with that name. And he was guaranteed that his name would be changed immediately.
Oh, shit.
And this goes back to my point I was bringing up years and years ago. Because of the lack of political power and because of the lack of economic power, the R word continues to reign in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The R word continues, and even African Americans, support the R word. And being African American, you should know better.
Make that dumb, African American.
All the oppression African Americans are going through, you should understand that this word is not right.
Yeah. Indeed. Make that dumb, African Americans. You know,
well,
endorse
you
that word.
African American man. Who dresses up in Native American gear and parades around?
Mm-hmm.
And he lives. And
yeah.
He thinks it's really cool. And he's become the mascot of the Washington Football Club.
Yeah.
And Black Man. Okay? This is the kind of nonsense and lo and behold, African-Americans
ball for the okey-doke. Yep. This is designer saltine action, brother. This is beyond cracker because he's telling you he's never changing the name. You're spending your money on jerseys, on caps, and all kinds of apparel. He's not changing the name. And we know if he changed the name, he'd make even more money. This is how arrogant he is. He paid $800 million for the name and the team and everything else, G. And the team's almost worth twice as much without him really doing anything. And yet he's still going to tell people that it's more important for him to maintain his arrogance. This is a Jew saying this now. So you'll think about how insulting and how arrogant he is in putting this in front of you, saying he'll never change the name. All right, if you're willing to give him your money after that, God bless you. I would think differently.
But see, again, like ESPN, right? If the people need to voice their opposition. If we say, okay, no more, right? Example, I got so angry at ESPN because what they did to Brother LeBron James. Now, look, I'm not a LeBron James fan. I said, look, enough is enough. I wrote an article, and you know what they did? They just ran around and parade LeBron James all week long on the network. It's craziness like this. And today on the network, they criticized the Williams sisters again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they should be happy because all the Europeans are at Wimbledon. They should be happy. So they got the injury and criticized Venus Williams. I mean, come on. Enough is enough.
But see, that's deliberate again because they know that Venus has been struggling with illness and injury for years. But it didn't stop them from taking a pot shot. Because remember, out of all of the surfaces, Venus has gotten the bulk of her titles on grass, and she loves Wimbledon. You know, if there's ever any time that you know if Venus is going to get geared to play, she's going to kick butt at Wimbledon. And she didn't get a chance to play for that very reason, for the same illness. So this is something they've known for years, but it doesn't stop them from attacking them with gusto whenever the opportunity presents themselves. Because just as with LeBron, when Serena wins, it's like, oh, dagnabbit, you know, now we got to deal with her, you know, smiling and all of that. And, you know, we have to deal with them like that. So, boom, here we are with this BS. And now that they got what they wanted, It takes away from the efforts of the other tennis players as well because they're playing just as hard and they're trying to earn a spot too. So I got no hate on for the other ladies on the tour. It's just that ESPN has magnified this crap to such a level that it infects the play. So you don't even get to appreciate when somebody does play hard and plays well and beats somebody because some days you just get beat. And those things can't be accounted for or enjoyed because of the poison that ESPN pours into the mix.
Well, I really believe it's time for us to write down all the commercials ESPN runs, write them down, and write those companies and say, if you don't do X, Y, Z, we are not buying your product.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet you within 3 weeks they will change their tune very fast.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it, brother.
I'm going to take a break. I need to go to L.A. City L.A. I'll be back in about 3 minutes. I'm gonna play Alicia Keys and Yehon. I'm gonna call LA now and see what's happening.
All right.
Take it wrong. Alicia Keys, hey, you know what that is? My home city, New York. Come on, Alicia.
Hallelujah.
podcast. Lisa Keys in New York, my favorite city, my favorite town. I think we have our guest. I got an email from KCAA, Dan Sydney, Southland. Got me there.
Yes, I'm here. How are you? Thank you very much for having me.
Can you introduce yourself to the crowd, to the people, so we can get started?
Okay, I'm Kathleen Wells with, I have the Kathleen Wells Show on KCAA AM 1050. You can find it on the internet at kcaaradio.com. I have a Wednesday show where I talk about politics. It's the Kathleen Wells Show. And I just finished, 2 hours ago, my Saturday show, which is Palestine Today. My co-host on that show is Harry Fear. He reports live from Gaza.
We also have our guest, Michael Lewis Ingram from the Soldier Radio Raw, and Michael, come on in here and say hello to Kathleen Wells.
Kathleen, good afternoon. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Okay.
I want to mention one other plug, if you guys don't mind. If you don't mind, I also do political commentaries for the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, which you can access on any mobile app. I'm kind of old school. I don't have any of these fancy devices. But I've been told that you can access it on your smartphones and all these other fancy things as an app. It's the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. You can also access it online, the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. Every week I do a new commentary, and actually for the last 3 weeks I've been commentating on the Zimmerman trial.
Mm-hmm. Lead right into the situation here. The prosecution ended its case yesterday, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. I have a problem with this. I have a problem with this man, the way he's presented in this case. And the reason why I have a problem is right from the beginning, they think it was a joke. It's not a joke. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're prosecuting a case, a murder case, can you be more serious than it's not a joke with not a joke?
Well, actually, it was the defense, Don West, the defense defending George Zimmerman, that started the case with the knock-knock joke. And
yes.
The knock-knock joke. I think the prosecution, who is the state, and they represent the death of Trayvon Martin, I think the prosecution's opening argument was excellent. I loved it. He said something to the effect, and I don't want to curse, but he said, you know, he used Zimmerman's words to something to the effect, I'm trying to tap my memory, like, these a-holes always get away. Yeah. And I loved that opening statement from the prosecution.
Okay. When he called the police, the police directed him to stay in the car. We would be there. Now, my issue with him is, why he got a car, and that means that he is an aggressor. Is that correct?
Well, it wasn't the police. It was actually the 911 dispatcher. And I don't know if he has any kind of official police authority. He's the 911 dispatcher. But I would think that he has some kind of authoritative responsibilities. So the question you asked me, was he the aggressor because he got out of the car when the 911...
Wasn't he told to stay in his vehicle?
Yes, he was told. The 911 dispatcher specifically asked Zimmerman, "Are you following him?" And when you listen to the 911 call, you can actually hear the chime when you open the door and you hear a door chime. So, and Zimmerman responded, "Yes, I am." And the 911 dispatcher said, "We don't need you to do that."
Yes.
Mhm. So yes. And so he continued to follow. Now, and you've got all these inconsistent statements from George Zimmerman as to whether or not he followed him or not.
All right, and then the next thing is about the DNA. There was no DNA and no blood on the murder weapon, and let me get this right. There's no blood or DNA from Martin, is that right?
Well, in fact, I just did I record my commentaries for the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. I'm giving that other plug again. I record them every Saturday at the station, KCAA, and I just recorded one today about the fact that the medical examiner, Dr. Rao, the woman, Valerie Rao, testified that the injuries that Zimmerman suffered were very insignificant and very minor. That's one thing. Then there were two medical examiners that testified on behalf of the prosecution. The second medical examiner, Dr. Bao, testified on Friday that Zimmerman did not have any significant injuries. No, I take that back. Trayvon Martin did not have any significant injuries at all, and he only had minor abrasions on, and not, and I'm saying abrasions, in other words, not contusions, not anything significant, just like scratches on his two fingers on his left hand, and also he had no abrasions, no contusions, no scratches on his right hand, and Trayvon Martin is right-handed, so if he's punching Zimmerman, wouldn't he punch?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fighter, so those out there who know how to have a fight, when you're punching a guy, do you punch them with your left hand if you're right-handed? That's the question.
There you go.
my last question before I turn over to Michael, the issue of Zimmerman's injuries. When he went to the police station, the police did not detain Zimmerman, and they did not give him a blood test or a sobriety test or any drug test. Why is that, please? Kathleen.
Oh, that is for me. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I thought you were asking Michael. Is your name Michael?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, Mike. I thought you were asking Michael. Okay, a question for me.
I'm asking you. When Zimmerman went to the police station the first time,
right, I got the question.
Was he given a sobriety test or a blood test?
Well, I mean, I think it's safe to assume that the Sanford Police Department was negligent in many aspects of their duties because they didn't even, the state attorney, Wolfinger, decided, despite what Police Officer Serino wanted to charge initially Zimmerman with manslaughter, but he was overridden, is that the right way to say it? That decision was overridden by state attorney Wolfinger. So it's, you know, I think I don't know. We don't know why they didn't perform that. Why didn't they perform any test on Zimmerman? And that wasn't asked by the prosecution. So we're only assuming that the police, Sanford Police Department, was negligent in their duties. And also maybe they were negligent because they believed Zimmerman's account. They believed his account. They felt that he had the defense of stand your ground. And so they were sort of laxed. Or maybe there were, you know, George Zimmerman's dad is a former magistrate. So maybe the dad called.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. That's like an X. That's like a That's like an unknown, you know. That's an unknown variable. But what, and the prosecution didn't ask it, and maybe he will now that the defense has started their case, maybe the prosecution will ask the defense witnesses, why didn't you do that?
Michael, you have any questions for Kathleen Wellstein?
Yes, indeed. Kathleen, again, thanks for taking some time to talk with us this afternoon. I was somebody who really not – I didn't want to take time watching this because I knew it would only make me angry. And one of the things that really bothered me was the treatment of Rachel Jontel when she was cross-examined – rather, when she was examined on – when she was on the stand. And what was even more damaging was what was said about her afterward, and not just from the daughter of the prosecuting team, but or the defense team, but from black people who were making fun of her almost in the self-same manner as what happened with the man from Ohio who helped free those girls from that slavery situation. It's like, did we miss the boat here? Here this woman speaks two more languages more than most of the people that are criticizing her.
Well, I actually, as I said, I do commentaries. I've been doing three. And the commentary I did last night is actually a love letter to Rachel Jontel. Because Rachel Jontel is a black woman. I'm a young girl, actually. But in the commentary, I said we're both black women. So I'm Rachel Jontel. And so because even if, you know, I may be a little luckier in some areas of my life than Rachel Jontel, but I'm still a black woman. And
exactly.
Black women are seen as don't want to be, they don't want to hear us. They don't want our point of view. We're seen as invisible. Despite my education and despite the fact that I have a radio show, I experience some of the same things Rachel Jontel experiences. So it doesn't even matter. It's just the fact that you're black, you're denigrated, you're not believed, you're incredulous, they want to see you as invisible. And so, yeah, I send her a love letter in my commentary because her and I are one and the same. And also, I feel that it disheartened me that a lot of black folks were denigrating her because they just don't get it.
Yes. In that vein, I want to make the point that she made the point that Trayvon was somebody who always treated her right, that he never made fun of her, and it speaks to character. As we know, we've seen websites actually come up designed to trash Trayvon and social media to make falsehoods up and stuff. Are you afraid that this is more and has become more about big business? And I mean the trial itself. Because ever since OJ, this whole stuff has become businesses. There weren't cable channels or channels dedicated to this whole process until that trial and the subsequent decision. So is this all part of big, or do you feel the business aspect of this, you know, poisoning the actual guilt and innocence of all of this?
Oh, well, definitely, without a doubt, because I know specifically I was working at Court TV during the O.J. Simpson trial. They had a regional office here in Los Angeles, and I'm in Los Angeles, and so I was working at the regional office. And I remember specifically that the court reporter in the O.J. Simpson trial made millions of dollars.
Millions?
Yes, because it was pages and pages.
Oh, my God.
And every agency, every news outlet that wants copies of the transcript, which is volumes and volumes, hundreds of pages, they have to pay something like $5 or whatever it is.
A page?
Per page.
Wow.
So you can imagine the hundreds of, and they pay it to the court reporter. So you can imagine the hundreds, if not thousands, of pages in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Oh, my God.
Exactly. In other words, she never had to work again after that.
No joke.
This also led to the proliferation of ESPN.
Right.
Because the reason why I said that is because ESPN was a relatively unknown station until the OJ trial. And all of a sudden, ESPN became think you're right. I think it exploded in many different ways.
It explodes in so many different ways. They make huge money off of these trials. So that's just one aspect of it. Another aspect of the corporatization of justice is the fact that many of the defenders of Zimmerman are Second Amendment gun rights advocates.
Mm-hmm.
So you could, that's another aspect. So, you know, all of our lives have become so corporatized. Justice is corporatized. The prison industrial complex is privatized and corporatized.
Yep.
So what it comes down to is everything is about big business and money. So this is what capitalism is. Capitalism is before justice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my question, Kathleen, that I wanted to go into. How many other sidebars in terms of the case itself? And you just mentioned a couple of them, you know, the prison industrial complex and Second Amendment nuts, you know, and all this. How many other sidebars do you see further developing from this that maybe a layperson didn't see when it was just a question of guilt or innocence?
How many
other sidebars in terms of how many other factors outside of just trying to get the justice come into play now because this is such big business? You know, what are the lay fans who are watching this stuff who don't care about anything but hoping this guy is convicted? What else are they not seeing?
Exactly. There's so much. I mean, so I can tell you specifically that the millionaire, the woman who was a court reporter in O.J. Simpson, became a multimillionaire just from typing the transcript. Now, I know that with absolute certainty, right? So then
mm-hmm.
What things don't we know, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know nothing about the NRA people, that corporatization,
yep.
that corporate enterprise. I don't know anything about that. But we can only imagine all of the, like, different corporate influences into these trials. In fact, there was
mm-hmm.
a judge who was sent to prison recently, I think out of New York, who was sending young kids, adolescents, to prison and to some juvenile prison camp and getting paid.
That was Pennsylvania. Yeah,
exactly.
That was Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
So it's just this like web of
mm-hmm.
corruption and money and corporate, you know. And then I even know of a case out of New York where the judge was sent to prison for taking bribes in divorce
yes.
cases.
Mm-hmm.
So listen, there is no justice, and there never has been though. But now it's even worse.
But now that you know all of this, and you see this trial unfold, and from what I have seen, the clear inconsistencies in what Zimmerman said happened, how it translates to all the different times he stepped on his own words, bushes being there where they weren't bushes, and
mm-hmm.
you know, the injuries and the lessening of them in his mind, and the maximizing them in other situations. How much of this stuff are you looking at with an observant eye and being objective at the same time, but, you know, underneath you're saying, when are we going to fry this guy, and why are y'all wasting all this time? Y'all know doggone well he's guilty.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're never going to. I mean, they have to. Even if he is guilty, you
mm-hmm.
have, you know, the law is that you. We don't know he's guilty. The decision of guilt or innocence is decided by a juror,
right.
juries. So, and that's our system. That's our criminal justice system. So even a defendant that is seen in the most heinous and egregious light is entitled to defense. That's a constitutional right for any defendant.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the process, the trial just has to go forth, and the
yep.
process, yeah. So we can't, I mean, even though, you know, us as lay people say, oh, we think he's guilty, that's our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But, and even if we think he's guilty, if the jurors decide he's not guilty, that's the system. That's the
yeah.
system.
That leads me to my next question, is that, why did the prosecution pick all these females on the jury? I don't get that.
Well, I don't know why. I think that it's not. Well, the prosecution didn't choose them. I've been watching the trial since the voir dire, which is when they're questioning the jurors, and they have so many peremptory challenges. I think 10 for each side, and then you can challenge a juror for cause. And when you challenge for cause, you have to state specifically why you think. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a procedure that goes forth. So I remember during the voir dire, there were 40 potential jurors, and of that 40, 10 were black. And the defense dismissed all 10. And his reason for dismissing them was race neutral, because you can't have a race reason for dismissing the jurors. So it was a race neutral reason. Like, for instance, and this is what's so fascinating to me, is that most of the white jurors said, most if not all of the white jurors said that race has nothing to do with this case. Most of the black jurors would say, yes, I think race has something to do with this case.
Echoes to America, see it needed black and white. I've been saying this for years. America always needed black and white. And this is a clear case of this.
Oh, I think it's very clear here, because when you listen to the legal pundits on TV, on HLN or CNN, 9 chances out of 10, if the pundit is black, they're pro Trayvon. If they're white, they're pro Zimmerman. This is like the elephant in the room, and nobody talks about it. It's like how can you rely on people's analysis of a trial when they don't talk about the elephant in the room, which is race?
I'm going to bring up my buddy from Northern California. Do you have any questions?
Hi, Kathleen. I'm also an attorney, and a general question I've had, because Gary has been looking forward to your appearance for a while. Do you think a case like Trayvon Martin's case is simply an unfortunate event that happens in a town with tragic consequence, but doesn't in and of itself have national significance, that somehow the media grabs onto these things and inflates it and it becomes of national significance, but in and of itself is not all that important a case?
Oh, definitely not. As I said, race is always an issue for black people and people of color, Hispanics, brown, black, yellow. Race is an issue in America. For whites, race is never an issue in America. You could just see that in the voir dire with the jurors. The white jurors never said, they said race is not an issue. For the black jurors, race is an issue. And, you know, I did a commentary on that for the Progressive Voices Channel, saying that we live in two Americas. And we live in two Americas. And Rachel Gentile reflects that second America. And all of us that live in that other America, all of us black folks and brown folks, we understood Rachel Gentile. We thought she was very authentic. But all the other people in the other America, which is white America, they did not understand her. So this case, Trayvon Martin, is a racial issue, because George Zimmerman would not have thought him suspicious but for the fact he were black.
But how is it that this single unfortunate event acquires national significance?
Well, it took national significance, 2 million votes, 2 million signatures on a petition for them to actually arrest George Zimmerman. But for those 2 million signatures on a petition, George Zimmerman would not even have been arrested in Sanford, Florida. So Sanford, Florida has a particular problem with stand your ground. It has a particular problem with racism. So it took the nation signing 2 million signatures on a petition to galvanize Sanford, Florida to do the right thing. But for those signatures, George Zimmerman would not have been arrested. And that, you know, and this is the same thing about states' rights. You see, this is why we need the federal government, the long arm of the federal government, to intercede and interject into what states do. Because you've got these states, particularly in the South, I'm not saying racism doesn't exist in the North, but particularly in the South, you have these states that do these things that are totally not kosher, that are totally racial in every sense of the word, like not even arresting George Zimmerman when Serrano, the police detective, police investigator, said that he should have been charged with manslaughter. So you need the federal government to step in and say, hey, wait a second. It's the same thing with the Voting Rights Act. But for the federal government saying, hey, wait a second, Texas. Hey, wait a second, Mississippi. Hey, wait a second, South Carolina. Blacks should vote, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now, of course, we just had the Supreme Court stripping out an important section of the Voting Rights Act.
Say that again?
We've just had the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, stripping out a significant section of the Voting Rights Act.
Right. Yes. Section 4, I think it is.
And I'll say it once again. If our President of the United States did not have a national conference on race for the next 2 years, we will never have another chance to talk about race ever again. This is the time, this is the place, and now.
Gary,
well,
if I can't.
Why do you think that President Obama is not taking this issue on? Is it for the obvious reason that he himself is black and can't really bring it to the fore and would become a lightning rod for that issue?
I think Brother Man has tried three times to get his attention to the agenda, and he's trying to placate and all of the masses, and you can never placate all the masses. You have to do what you got to do. If you're president, you have the right. You have the executive office to have executive privilege and faster laws. Yes, Congress can get around it, but it'll be very difficult for them to do. But this president need to deal with race. This country is at the crossroads when it comes to race. If we don't deal with this in the next 3 years, America's in trouble.
You know, Gary, the last president to really speak on race and have his words matter was Jimmy Carter. Because you remember, Carter came up from the South, you know, when asides were made about black folks, he said something about it. He was always characterized as being weak after what was done abroad. But let's be real here. You know, when Attorney Holder said that we were cowards when it came to race, he signed his own death warrant career-wise because ultimately that's what led to the whole Fast and Furious BS. They compromised him because they knew one day Holder might be a potential Supreme Court judge or surely could be. And that would change the temper of the court. When you look at what Bush did in seating it with Alito and Roberts, knowing that the swing and the attitude of the overall court would be compromised, for lack of a better word of putting it, for at least 25 years, given the young ages comparatively of Alito and Roberts, you know, it's a heinous thing. That it was probably more heinous what Bush did there than a lot of the stuff he did in all the wars. But when Holder said these things, they made a point of going after him because they had to make sure that when the time came, if somebody even thought about Holder, that they could compromise him with negative spin. This is part of a bigger problem that I'm afraid for all of the wherewithal that the president has, for as smart as he is and has been in having to just deal with the forces around him to even make it to a second term, this is something that's a back burner issue, in my opinion, because the stuff that really needs to be stuff up front, like jobs, like taking care of veterans, not having states' rights go buck wild so that women's invasive ultrasound is mandatory and, you know, you're taking away abortion clinics at the same time for those who have a right to choose. These are just things where we have one thing on top of a whole bunch of other things, and it's a plate that's too full, and instead of folks eating at it, it's going to get spoiled because it's just sitting there.
Kathleen,
Oh, I agree with everything that was said. I agree with everything Michael said completely. And I, in fact, I, on my Wednesday show, I just had Dr. Frances Cress Welsling, who wrote
that's
the
my sister, ISIS papers. Yes, I'm sorry.
Right, and that's what she said. I just had her on Wednesday, and she was saying the exact same thing. Eric Holder said, we are cowards as Americans to discuss race in America, and race is the cancer destroying our country. And, you know, I got on Twitter recently tweeting about this Zimmerman trial, which is rare for me because I don't really do Twitter. And I realize that, because when I would tweet certain things, the responses I would get for people defending Zimmerman, I realized that many of them are Second Amendment advocates. That's many of them. And then another of them are just like haters of black and brown folks. They just hate them, you know. So, and that's not going to change. That's not going to change. In fact, I just put on my Facebook page, there's another Zimmerman who was on Big Brother who just can you imagine another Zimmerman who was on Big Brother who just called, she called welfare the N-word insurance.
Yes. Yes, I remember that.
So it's like we can't discuss race for some reason, and this is what I've learned in researching the issue of racism, interviewing about it. What it is really is white supremacy, and I now go along with the definition that Dr. Frances Cress Welsley uses, which I had never before, but it's about white supremacy, that whites must, and it's not. And when I say white supremacy, I'm not talking about the KKK brand, and I'm not criticizing white people. I'm talking about a system, and that we have to differentiate between the system of racism and white supremacy as a system, and then on one hand, and then white people as people on the other hand. They're two different things. So I'm talking about a system that must preserve white supremacy. In other words, white as superior, white as better, white as the best, white as right. Do you understand? So, of course, they're going to have... Go ahead.
That leads me to my next question. Mrs. Zimmerman has been afforded male privilege. I think what this guy got away with is male privilege. We all know that Mrs. Zimmerman was black and Delmar was white. What would be happening right now? He'd be underneath the jail, okay? Mm-hmm. But because Mrs. Zimmerman is the son of a judge, he gets privilege.
Mm-hmm.
When he's living in jail, he can walk around free. That's privilege.
Yeah, but Gary, you have to look at the fact too that one, he is being prosecuted. Two, it's my understanding there was a $30 million civil settlement from either the city of Sanford or that county. It doesn't bring Tayvon Martin back, but there was at least a recognition there by government that a mistake was made, that Zimmerman, acting in his quasi-official watch person capacity, committed an act that resulted in a wrongful death. So there was a payment there. My concern with Michael, and I think Kathleen correctly kind of brought him up short, is let's let the justice system unwind. Rather than saying, okay, we know he's guilty, let's fry him. I mean, that's the flip side of lynching.
But that's the other side. I appreciate what you're saying, but let me, Gary, if you...
Hold on, one minute here.
Sure.
As a black man, I've been in America for 60 years. This will be 60 years. In 60 years, the African-American man has a bullseye on the back of his head. By police, by civil servants, by other white men. And what Mr. Zimmerman did was inexcusable. And yes, he had white privilege.
let's flip the script on this, because at no time, according to testimony that's already out, did Zimmerman say, "Hey, I'm from the neighborhood watch. What are you doing here?" He had the safety off on his holster. So even if we give everything the benefit of the doubt, his safety off once he left the car is intent, because he surely didn't have to have, if he has the safety off, we don't have this. Maybe we have a scuffle. Maybe we have something else. The kid's
right.
Still alive. So all of these variables were made out in front of what the prosecution put before everybody, and there's just too many holes in it.
Yeah.
And may I finish, please? If we're talking about just frying somebody, no, we're not talking about just frying somebody, but you better believe there is a stilted justice here, or a lack of, because as we're speaking on this, there's a black woman who's sitting in a Florida jail right now for not killing somebody because she stood her ground. She fired a weapon in the air, to have the person leave, and she's doing 20 hard time for protecting herself. She didn't hurt anybody. She didn't kill anybody. She didn't take anyone's life. But she's in jail behind Stand Your Ground. He has killed someone for the same thing. And if this were a black person and Trayvon were white, there's no way, given what we see in this court, not necessarily trying to be unfair, but what we see in this country, from where we see it in this country, there's no way that that man is going to be walking around free. He's in jail.
And that may well be the result, but that result has to, you know, take its time to get there. You know, and then looking at him as an individual, I mean, who he appears to be is, you know, like the equivalent of some kind of, you know, security guard at Kmart who decides all of a sudden, you know, he's John Wayne or something like that. You know, an individual, you know, perhaps a weak-minded individual, perhaps a racist individual, who decides that this is his moment of glory. And that's my concern about the case, is we're taking an unfortunate event with perhaps a weak-minded, you know, overfed, you know, halfway neighborhood watch, not even rent-a-cop, who decides that this is going to be his moment of glory.
I would contend the weak-minded
point. And that flawed individual, with his highly flawed act, results in an unfortunate death.
But we
take that and we inflate that to a matter of national significance.
I don't think we inflate it, because I don't think he was weak-minded. You don't take martial arts and be weak-minded. I think he's representative. Zimmerman is representative of a lot of unstable men who go through police academy or want to be policemen, and they don't have the mental jam for it. And even those few criteria in some police academies give red flags, and they realize this guy's a nut. He'd be a time bomb if we gave him a gun and a license to kill people. So I think he's not as much weak as he is blessed.
He is representative of white supremacy. I mean, he's not an exception to the rule, and that's what you're saying. You're trying to say Zimmerman is an exception to the rule. No, we have many cases like this, and unless you study it, you don't know it. There are many cases like this. There are many Oscar Grant, whether even police.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's the whole point. It's the system of white supremacy and racism is impacting the black and brown communities adversely. And until we can look at the system of racism and white supremacy and get it straight, nothing is going to change. George Zimmerman is not the exception. He's not like someone living in a isolated kind of, he's not isolated. He's not in a bubble. He's the norm.
Yeah.
He is the norm. There are too many cases. There are too many cases like this.
And what Zimmerman had done, the guys in New York, Chicago, L.A., wherever, they do this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time.
And so when I... Yeah, and, you know, know, you and I are legally trained, so of course we are trained to say, let the system work out, let the system work. But the system is not working. It's not working for black folks. It's not working for brown folks. It only works for white folks. And is that a democracy and is that justice? That's the ultimate question. And so we have to get a new system for black people in America to get justice.
What institutional changes might you propose to try to accomplish that?
I would propose one definite institutional change, that prosecutors who use their positions to jack up their won-loss records by railroading people be subjected to the same penalties if they're busted for doing exactly that. They need to be under a jail because they're given a covenant of responsibility that they break the minute they try to fudge something or take away something that would mean the difference between guilt or innocence in a man's life or a woman's life. We've had states go on total moratoriums with the death penalty for that very reason, because prosecutors are trying to jack up numbers and railroad people who may not be able to afford legal counsel. So if we're going to put any kind of institutions in there, let them have a caveat emptor in place, making them understand that their ass will fry if they deliberately use their power to an abusive level and cause erroneous situations that lead to people being jailed. You know, money is money, but money can't bring back a person's life. Ironically, being from New York, I just seen the documentary about the Central Park Five and all the crap that they went through with the prosecution and the police here in New York City. They're still trying to get money and restitution that they'll never get back.
And the woman who prosecuted them in that case is now a professor at Columbia.
Exactly. And how can she sleep at night saying how she knew this and that and talked about all of this when they're coercing confessions from these young men about how they lifted up the skirt of a jogger? I repeat, lifted up the skirt of a jogger, and they let all of that nonsense go. Not just these legal people, but the media in swallowing this thing whole. Prosecutors should be subject to penalty and of the same, if not equal penalty or worse, for the type of situation where they allow this kind of stuff to continue. Then maybe they do their job a little bit better and they'd be a little bit more forthright. And this is not to piss on good prosecutors, but obviously those who think stepping up means that they have to step on the backs of poor people who can't defend themselves.
Yeah, and you just have to look at 60 Minutes every Sunday to see the corruption and how much it abounds throughout our society and our legal system. And, in fact, there was a prosecutor in Texas that had withheld some exculpatory evidence. I just was watching the other night Brooklyn DA or something like that. The
yes.
prosecutor there was being charged with holding back exculpatory evidence. He denies it. I mean, and I don't think that these are exceptions. I think this is more the norm. I don't know the statistics, you know, I haven't done a study to know exactly what are the statistics, but it happens much too frequently. It happens much too frequently. It shouldn't happen at all because these prosecutors take an ethical duty to uphold the law. And so they must present exculpatory evidence. And also, I think another thing would be to, when you have a victim who is black, I think that there should be a requirement that a certain percentage of the jurors are black.
What happened in Simi Valley years ago, that never did happen. With Rodney King case, they moved it out of L.A. to Simi Valley. It never did happen. And those guys got off.
Yeah, we deny that race is an issue in America. Race is one of the main issues in America, but we deny it. We pretend it isn't.
Anyone who says that color is not an issue is a liar, because you can't get around color. You see it all the time, and you don't see white and black only signs on bathrooms and soda fountains, or water fountains rather, and in restaurants anymore. But the implying of same still exists. And until that atmosphere is gone, there has to be a way to even the playing field so that people will get their day in court, so that somebody won't lose a case because they don't have a large bank account or financial access to legal assistance that will get their butts out of trouble when they've done dirty.
And we know race matters because of Michelle Alexander's book, Mass Incarceration, The New Jim Crow. That's what we're living in, a new Jim Crow. In other words, Jim Crow has taken on a different form, but it's still Jim Crow, and it's called mass incarceration. And what the police in New York and every city across the United States, they don't target purple people. They target black young men and brown young men. Because we also know that more than half of the drug arrests in the last 30 years were more than half of the increase in arrest in the prison explosion in the last 30 years, more than half of that is for nonviolent drug offenses. And we also know that all groups use drug, all groups, white, black, brown, use drugs at the same rate. And in fact, whites use drugs more than blacks. Yet, the police target black folks for drug arrest. There's too much evidence. We already know what's going on, but we're not where our head, like Eric Holder said, like Michael just said, we don't discuss it. So what is wrong with our society that we can't speak the truth?
Last thing about our question is the media. The media is the right-hand arm of the justice system. In the OJ case, if the media stayed away, it would be a different story. And because the media made it into a big circus, it's what happened. See, the media has to step back and take responsibility for some of the nonsense too.
Well, Gary, I think as Kathleen said earlier, all of this stuff becomes a product. It becomes corporatized. And it has really very little to do with, say, the First Amendment right or truth or publishing truth or speaking truth to power or anything. It just becomes a product. And all of these things, when we look at, all of these cases are unfortunate cases. The woman who, whose baby drowned in the swimming pool. The woman who, and that was a white case. The woman who shot her Mormon boyfriend and stabbed him 37 times. A white case happens in Arizona and Utah. Tragic cases with unfortunate people. But these cases do not have, those two cases in and of themselves do not have a national significance. They are tragic, unfortunate events with, perhaps sick, disturbed people at their core. But the media seizes onto this, and we have Nancy Grace beating the drums, to fry these people. But we see that across the board, how the law has become a program. You get a case that has sensational facts and unfortunate facts or lurid facts, and that becomes a product, and it stirs the pot, and it gets people riled up.
Well, if race is an issue in a case, it's sensation, it's national news, but they don't discuss race.
Exactly. Yeah. When Charles Stewart killed, hold on, if I can add this, when Charles Stewart killed his wife in Boston, and then said a black man did it. And Boston was turned upside down because, yes, the perpetrator, the suspect, was a black male. And it turned out he had bumped his own wife off and shot himself to make it look as if he had been accosted by a black man. The after effect was, oh, never mind. But the bottom line was, had a black man truly done that, we would have seen lynchings. Mm-hmm. So, let's not be coy and imply that this atmosphere doesn't exist, because race is what makes it exist in the first place. Lynching's not something that's born of the South. There were almost as many lynchings in New York State as it was in Mississippi in 1930. But having said all of that, we can go across the map of this country, and according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there's more hate groups in New Jersey than there are
in North Carolina and Mississippi. So race is a factor, whether folks want to admit it or not. Ultimately, we have to confront this. And maybe the founding fathers hadn't designed all of this when they wrote down that noble piece of paper, but we have to assume that they had to be thinking about it because they were sitting around with slaves of their own. So the fact that they wrote in that, well, we'll consider them three-fifths of a human being is also in our legal construct, whether folks want to admit it or not. Maybe they don't recite it chapter and verse in summation, but it definitely infects the whole process. And unless people are going to be honest enough to speak about it, there's going to be a major problem, and the Trayvons will keep adding up, and when it's all told, they'll say what they say whenever a black or a Latino or a person of color is bumped off. It's a tragic accident.
But the media, it is the media's fault. Because, see, the media is like playing the American people. Because they highlight the racial cases, but they say race isn't an issue. So they're like playing us for fools, the American people. So it's like the media is responsible for the failings of life in America. We're all being played by the media.
Tuna Smith is a great example of this. Tuna Smith drove her two kids into the river. What is Tuna Smith saying? Tuna Smith said a black guy did it. A black guy kidnapped her kid and drove her into the lake. Right? What came out of that case? Tuna Smith drove her kid into the lake herself.
And wasn't she convicted of that, Gary?
Yeah, but
why would she even say a black kid?
But meantime,
you know what the media does? It merges and morphs blackness with criminality. The media does that with these shows, Cops, and all these other shows that on TV. Oh, the black suspect, and then they flip it and say. So they've merged in the mind of the American public that blacks are criminals. They put that in their mind.
If I can throw this in the pot, we need to understand this. In 1983, there were 50 consortiums, companies, whatever you want to call it, that were all part of what we would all call the mainstream media. 30 years later, that number is down to 6. And it doesn't matter whether it's Fox News or MSNBC, you still get that same impression. As much as MSNBC waxes liberal, Friday nights, what's on their programming?
Exactly.
Prisons. And
exactly.
It's the highest rated thing that their station generates. Not Rachel Maddow, not Melissa Harris-Perry or Ed Show or any of that other stuff. It's prisons. So they're counting just like Fox is counting. And even though Fox is... Everyone's editorializing. You're not getting real news. But when you see that kind of atmosphere, it doesn't allow for anyone who is a have-not to get a fair shake. And if they just happen to be a have-not who is not Caucasian, they're in deep doo-doo.
I agree. It's the media. They keep the division and the ambiguity and the unease and the misunderstanding. They perpetrate it and make money off of it.
Yeah, and I think it's unfortunate that the media, creates this product out of other people's misfortune.
Right.
Whether it's cops or prisons or, again, the woman who drives her kids into the lake, the woman who, child dies in the swimming pool when she's off at the disco, or this woman who shoots her Mormon boyfriend and stabs him 37 times and we feast on that. I mean, it's a kind of sickness to feast on other people's misfortunes.
It is sickness. It's a sickness. And in fact, I heard an interview with the producer of Cops right here in Hollywood, and the person asked him specifically, don't you think that you're putting into the public this image that blacks are criminals? And he said, yeah. And it was like he had no compunction to admitting that, and he didn't feel that it was wrong.
What happened?
You know, we see it. I mean, just to strike a balance, and I don't disagree, but just to strike a balance, I mean, we see the same. Well, it's not the same. It's similar but different. This attention on, you know, lurid conduct, whether it's, you know, Jersey Shore, looking at these, you know, white Italian, you know, Jersey kids behaving badly. I mean, any of this, you know, Lindsay Lohan.
But you know what? Those Jersey kids are not going to get pulled over by the police and shot at. They'll tell them up against the wall, whatever. They're not going to shoot any of those Jersey kid types that you're talking about. If a bunch of black kids did that, they would be up against the wall. They would be shot at. You know, Sean Bell was shot not far from where I lived. For the same thing that you're talking about, guys going out on a bachelor party, you know, proceed certain ways, and the car's lit up. The man did nothing wrong, and now he's a corpse. That's not going to happen to any paisans who happen to be over at Belmar on the Jersey Shore.
And we know that's true because I watched Mob Wives. I mean, I'm a total cultural person. I watched Mob Wives, and one of the women's son was arrested and indicted and convicted for drug use, and they sent him off to a treatment facility. They don't send black kids out to a treatment facility. But I will say I understand what he's saying, that Hollywood does stereotype groups. Every group is stereotyped, the Amish, the Catholics, the Italians, every group except I want to see a group about rabbis harvesting organs. I want to see a movie like that.
I think you got the idea for a screenplay there.
No, but you guys got awful quiet on that one. In other words, we see that the Amish are, you know, criminals, blacks are criminals, Italians are in the mob.
Right.
You know, Catholics are pedophiles. So let's see rabbis harvesting organs.
Okay.
You know, I think that's the next step now. Besides, you know, to, you know, beyond Weeds and Dexter and Breaking Bad, I think you've just come up with the new dark, malevolent pitch here for, you know, sensational programming.
But what I'm saying is that Hollywood is basically not interested in showing us that. They don't show us that, although we know it goes on. And, in fact, they just had a program on – I also watched that Brooklyn show where the guy was taking body parts, bones from – did you see that on Brooklyn DA? Bones from people who had died. And these people, in fact, they had taken Alistair Cook's bones, which were infested with cancer. They took his bones and sold them on the market to companies that buy bones to replace them in other people to help them. Do you understand? In other words, these old bones, he was fraudulently taking bones that were infested with diseases such as cancer and HIV and hepatitis and selling them as healthy bones for other patients and making millions doing that. Now, when are we going to have a show about that?
I want to make this very clear, Art, that what can happen to different communities when that man in Boston, Massachusetts, who went into a black neighborhood and shot his wife and then shot himself. You know what the city of Boston did that weekend? The city of Boston shut down. Every African-American male was questioned. Right? Meanwhile, this young man who shot his wife is off, going off, doing every day that whole weekend. Every black man in that city was questioned. Is that right? No. But Boston did anyway. Why?
And ultimately, though, was that husband charged with the crime?
as he was. But in the meantime, African American men all over the city was accosted by a bunch of police.
So the issue is the double standard.
Yes.
Do we want justice for and equality for all Americans, or just for some?
That's the question.
Well, that's the question, and for me, I think, you know, clearly, I mean, the answer that we prefer is for all. You know, the next question becomes how do we accomplish that, and that's been a long struggle that, you know, goes back 400 years, certainly goes back, you know, 50 years, you know, to Brown v. Board of Education, after that, you know, the Civil Rights Act. We're still struggling with it, and in some ways, I think you're right, we're not making any progress. And in some ways, going backward.
Yeah, we're going backwards, unfortunately. And if you read Michelle Alexander's book, Mass Incarceration, The New Jim Crow, it's clear we're going backwards.
Yeah.
The new Jim Crow now is just mass incarceration. It's still Jim Crow.
Right. And I would agree. I mean, that is the issue. I guess, you know, Gary and I talked a little bit about, you know, me coming on here to be kind of a counterpoint. And I believe that the mass incarceration issue is the true bigger issue. And somehow that issue is not really raised because we get sidetracked by a case such as the Tayvon Martin case, which my take on it, yes, it does have racial overtones, and I understand that, but is an unfortunate event, you know, where some over-amped, glorified security guard who maybe took martial arts training because he's a wannabe tough guy, and overstepped his bounds because, you know, this was his chance to be John Wayne, and a young man was killed. But in and of itself, I did not originally see the case as having national significance. I have since, through this discussion, come to see the point that you're making. But I think the bigger argument is to look at the issue of mass incarceration, because that really speaks to the national issue rather than a localized issue.
But we have been trying to deal with mass incarceration. In fact, President Obama said in his second term that he was going to take on mass incarceration. He hasn't yet. In fact, Russell Simmons and Dr. Boyce Watkins just sent President Obama a letter addressing that. In fact, the another human rights organization sent him a letter regarding mass incarceration. The Drug Policy Initiative. There are many organizations that have been begging the president to address this issue.
And the president won't do it because he's the president. That's the problem. If President Obama was Joe Blow, he could do it. But because he's the president, he's in a bind.
Well, Gary, I think you had anticipated.
He's in a political bind because of the government he's getting.
But I think, Gary, you had anticipated that with the second term and the fact that he would not have to run for re-election, that it would open up the door for him to take the gloves off and accomplish things that he could not do when he was looking at the need to become reelected. Gary, I think you've become disappointed that there's a whole host of issues that he has not spoken up on yet, and really that there's no indication that he's going to, even within the freedom of being a second-term president.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people predicted that
he would. Every second-term president has the year after he's elected, he pushes through the agendas. President Obama, that's my question.
Right.
He a lot of people predicted that, the second term, when he doesn't have to think about running again, he'll take on these issues. Well, he put women's rights, gay rights, and Hispanic rights / immigration, and he never talks about black rights or civil rights. And yet we were denied, the Supreme Court just said that the Voting Rights Act is meaningless, essentially, or it needs to go back to Congress to be addressed. And also, isn't there an affirmative action case now that went up to the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Yes, and it still need to be addressed. Yeah, that's getting. But my thing with I did it at the beginning of the show. We're gonna wrap it up right now because it's 309. We're over the limit. Yeah, we need a national conference on race with a black president. This is the time to do it. If we don't do it before 2016, it will never get done.
Well, I don't think he's going to do it. There's no way he's going to do it. If he hasn't done it now, he's not going to do it. I think it's quite clear what his priorities are. They're not black folks.
Okay.
And if he's speaking for a different agenda, I think in many ways, the any president, we see this perhaps most clearly. I mean, for me, I saw it when Ronald Reagan was the president, that he becomes merely a figurehead for the powers that be, whoever they are, that put him into office. I mean, I don't think Ronald Reagan had the intellectual firepower to be conceiving and executing matters of national policy. He was a spokesman for some powers that be. I think we see that clearly with George W. Bush. Barack Obama, clearly a bright person, but again, is he merely the figurehead for, whatever institutional interests put him into power?
Yep. Definitely.
That is.
Definitely. No doubt about it.
Yeah, and that those interests, and when you look closely at Obama, I mean, he had major support from the banking industry, from the insurance industry. I mean, these are the sort of the shadow facts that are there that you have to look at. And what is the constituency that he is responding to? And as you've established, it may well not be black people.
Exactly.
It's other groups and other interests.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I thank both of you guys to go on the air. Thank Michael Lewis Ingram and Calvin Reggie, wherever you are. Thank you for coming to Jennifer Cole. It's been an exciting and an enjoyable show. Interesting, informative. And Mr. Wells, you can come back to the Cole anytime. I'm going to try to get on your show one of these days.
Okay, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun discussing the issues, and I think we all agree. It's dismal. It's dismal.
Well, it might get better. We'll see what happens.
But at least we're talking about it, and that has to be a positive step.
Well, it has to be on a national level. When you have a sports network that can do what it does and get away with it without repercussions, there need to be discussions about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's
about
point.
That. The mouse, a.k.a. ESPN. That's racial stuff. We need to talk about that.
Well, that's a point that you consistently bring up, Gary, and I know you've hit that on your published articles, which is on blackathlete.com, or blackathlete.net, I believe, how ESPN skews its television coverage in a racial direction. And so I encourage people to look at your articles on that because you're exposing that secret agenda.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Have a good Saturday, folks, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for going to the air. And hope we can come back soon, Kathleen. Have a good weekend and a good night.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Breaking news. The aircraft got Boeing 777 has crashed in San Francisco Airport. From Seoul, Korea, there are many, many survivors because the plane did not break up. So we had survivors going to San Francisco Hospital. If you have friends or relatives, you need to call the airport or call San Francisco General Hospital. 12:45 today. The airport is closed. Emergency services are in session. Okay, well, I hope you have a good weekend. I hope you enjoyed the show today. And people, call if you have people in on the airline from Seoul, Korea. Get in touch with them as soon as you can. And have a good night as we go out with my man, great song. The black guy needs to know that.
Life's too high, no more black guy sleep. The thrill of it to be the agony of the truth.
Now we got the spirit that can never give in, with a heart that pumps stronger than 10 average men. It's something within, I was born to win. You can't hold me down, I'm a black champion. We had to fight for equal rights, on and off the court. At the turn of the century, dominated sports. For the love of the game, endured the pain, and forced through segregation, had to make a change. Jack Robinson, first black man to get a deal in the major league. Knocking homers out the field, let the whole lead in RBIs and steals. In his first year, MVP rookie of the year, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and then even Osa paved the way for Reggie Jackson, King Griffey, and Sammy Sosa. Half of all MVPs in the history of baseball since black athletes. That's why we excel on our feet, cause we believe mentally, physically, and spiritually. So all I wanna do is thank my God. We worked so hard, came so far, black athletes.
Life is the eyes of a black athlete. The victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat.
Now basketball is my favorite of all sports, cause there's so many black athletes that ever blessed the court. Will Chamberlain must be the most famous, scoring 100 points in a game, and no wonder through the same. Elgin Baylor, Bill Russell, and Connie Hawkins, who's the best to play the sport. Dr. J and Michael Jordan played above the rim when they score, hung in the air when they score. They move like never before. So all my black athletes, entrepreneurs, you open up the door. You deserve a round of applause. The pink skin, the grit iron, will bodies be colliding? And the men must be made of iron. Where would football be without the great Jim Brown? Force the pace, breaking tackles and running for touchdowns. So if you ever had to stop them, it'd be crushing. Because it still holds the record for the most yards rushing. Smooth with quick moves like dancers. And it's this time of day for the great Barry Sanders. All I want to do is thank my God who worked so hard. Came so far, black athlete.
Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat.
Jack Johnson, a heavyweight champion in 1910, fought the best of American men. And the fourth of the century took place on Independence Day, and the purse was 100 G's to pay. The most eagerly awaited event in American history, Jack Johnson versus Jim Jeffrey. Nothing Frederick Douglass ever did, nothing Booker T ever did, shocked the world like this did. The great white hope came tumbling down, beaten and bruised and knocked out in the 15th round. Muhammad Ali, the greatest heavyweight champion of all time, at least he was in his mind. He gained the heavyweight championship a record 3 times and successfully defended it 19 times. The third youngest, the third oldest heavyweight champion. His career spans 7 presidents.
Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat.
Charlie Stanford, the first black man to win the PGA. Made it pop, moved the Tiger Woods to play today. Althea Gibson, first black woman to win the Wimbledon. Arthur Ashe, we're his sisters. We love them through all of their trials and tribulations. Bad times we faced it and overcame the situation. Bill Owens won 4 gold medals in the 36th Olympics, breaking records and re-dipping the bill. And all the black women began to dominate. In track and field, they was great in 1948. And a team full of black women won 6 medals and represented in the 52 Olympics. Thanks to women who
eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete. The thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. Life through the eyes of a black athlete.